Good evening and welcome, dear ones. It is so good to see each of you again. And as I am aware that many of you registered just this week, so we're still at the sounding of a new octave, so to speak, a new beginning, together with our shared intention for the fullness of the human life. Again, it's a reminder that this school, the classes, all the offerings have a big wish for all of us to be able to actualize what is ours, a theophany of Christ, if you will, personally, each one of us. The Christ candle is again lit, as always, as a reminder of the eternal truth. And to call upon the conscious circle of humanity to gather with us and inform us. And so we begin with joy and intention in the name of the Father and of the Son and in the name of the Holy Spirit. God transcendent, God immanent, God omnipresent, the Holy Living Trinity. Amen. So, as always, we begin our evening with a remembrance, a reflection from the lineage of our teachers who have gone before us, opened the door, and shown us glimpses of a way of life. And tonight we're going to note and honor Jean de Salzman, who is widely regarded as Mr. Gurdjieff's most esteemed student. He gave her the responsibility of bringing forth his works. Her teachings, be they cosmic or psychological, will be woven throughout our curriculum during this year. Her birthday was January 26, 1889. And I always enjoy hearing the story that Mr. Gurdjieff asked her to live to be 100. And she lived to be 101. So it is always good to step forth just a little further than your teacher asks you to do. May it be so for us as well. This quotation comes from her book, The Reality of Being, The Fourth Way of Gurdjieff. And it's particularly appropriate because so much of the extra part of our curriculum begin next week. The journey groups, the work partner relationships, the resuming of a Beelzebub's Tales class, and others. So this is kind of a word for us. She says, why together? Why do we come together to work? We feel that if we do not participate in certain conditions, we will continue to be taken by habit and life circumstances in which we will be lost. Perhaps here together it will be possible to experience conditions in which a higher energy can appear in us and around us. We will then become responsible together to serve it. We come together because we each feel the necessity to become conscious of ourselves. So long as I am what I ordinarily am, that is, think as I think and feel as I feel, I will know nothing true, nothing real. I need to become conscious of my way of thinking and feeling, which conditions all my actions. Only the perception of truth unites. Real work together, cooperation, comes from a common understanding of truth, from the fact that we each see the truth and feel the necessity to put it into action together. The basis of this work is not a special approach, a special method, or special conditions. It lies above all in opening to another order in oneself and in others. Life is relation and working together, cooperation, seeing things together, feeling together, living together. This relation requires intensity at the same level and at the same time, or it is not together. So may it be so that we are together and become responsible together to serve this work on behalf of all humanity. May it be so in truth, with courage, in love. And as mentioned, the journey groups and work partner relationships began next week. At this point, you should have received word from your facilitator or your partner. But if you have not, you will soon hear from one another. So now we prepare ourselves for the evening. We come into presence of being, our own being. And how we come matters. How we participate matters. For we are each shaping this vestibule, if you will, this vessel, a container of influence. So we place ourselves here now, with intention and imminent trust and receptivity to the influences coming from the circle of conscious humanity. And we prepare to receive these influences with back upright, heart open, mind quiet, in directed attention. Body relaxed, noticing and then letting go of any tension, constriction, resistance. Open. We breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything. Everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy, surprise, all affirming, all denying, and we hold it as offering reconciled, as food for being. We lift it and ask that all be transubstantiated in our being as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing light into the world. All worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I yield to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. So now we enter into our period of Lectio Divina. And we will share our reflection three times with a silent pause in between each reading. O Lord our God, how awesome is your name through all the earth. When I see your heavens, the work of your hands, the moon and stars that you set in motion, what is man that you are mindful of him? Woman, that you care for her. Yet you have made them little less than gods, crowned them with glory and honor, with the divine spark of truth and life. That which is most imminent to us, our life, our breath, and our thoughts, are indicators of the divine presence within us. This life force hidden within us and leading us through daily life. It behooves us to seek our inner connection to it, to gain understanding of and relate to what is highest in the universe. How is it that we are even able to think of these things? How we are related to the universe and are able to gain knowledge of the lower cosmoses. Is it not miraculous? Man was given a mind so to think about the universe and move and scale and being, to be able consciously and voluntarily to serve purposes of higher, perhaps the highest intentions in the universal world. Intentions that create and maintain worlds upon worlds in the universal world. O Lord our God, how awesome is your name through all the earth. When I see your heavens, the work of your hands, the moon and stars that you set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, woman that you care for her? Yet you have made them little less than gods, crowned them with glory and honor, with the divine spark of truth and life. That which is most imminent to us, our life, our breath, and our thoughts are indicators of the divine presence within us. This life force hidden within us and leading us through daily life. It behooves us to seek our inner connection to it, to gain understanding of and relate to what is highest in the universe. How is it that we are even able to think of these things? How we are related to the universe and are able to gain knowledge of the lower cosmoses? Is it not miraculous? Man was given a mind so to think about the universe and move in scale and being, to be able consciously and voluntarily to serve purposes of higher, perhaps the highest intentions in the universal world. Intentions that create and maintain worlds upon worlds in the universal world. O Lord our God, how awesome is your name through all the earth. When I see your heavens, the work of your hands, the moon and stars that you set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him? Woman, that you care for her. Yet you have made them little less than gods, crowned them with glory and honor, with the divine spark of truth and life. That which is most imminent to us, our life, our breath, and our thoughts, are indicators of the divine presence within us. This life force hidden within us and leading us through daily life. It behooves us to seek our inner connection to it, to gain understanding of and relate to what is highest in the universe. How is it that we are even able to think of these things? How we are related to the universe and are able to gain knowledge of the lower cosmoses? Is it not miraculous? Man was given a mind, so to think about the universe and move and scale and being, to be able consciously and voluntarily to serve purposes of higher, perhaps the highest intentions in the universal world, intentions that create and maintain worlds upon worlds in the universal world. And so it is. I invite you, as you are moved to do so, to step forth and offer to share with us what you received from this passage or this extraordinary image. Good evening, Grady. Welcome.
Good evening. Just the word imminent to us brought another concept of interiority, the interior of ourselves, which connected to interbeing, which was in our January 26 meeting,
yes.
Thich Nhat Hanh. And then lastly, tying it all off, miraculous. Thank you.
Thank you, Grady. Yeah, miraculous indeed. There's something thrilling about that word. Jim, good evening.
Good evening. This passage reminded me of something I've been reflecting on lately, which is how the spirit guides me in just my day-to-day discernment through even the most mundane things that come up throughout the day. And the life force leading us through daily life, and that it behooves us to seek our inner connection to it.
Yes.
And to understand and relate to what is highest. I feel like at any given moment, if I'm faithful to my practices, that I'm centered, and I give myself space before reacting to a situation, that through my conscience, through my intuition, through sort of the persuasive energy of the spirit within me, God analyzes the situation moment by moment, and has in mind what is highest, what is maybe perhaps the best outcome. And the more I'm tuned into that energy, the more I can choose consciously the better option. rather than acting mechanically. And so these words help me connect to that desire to be close to that practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Melba, good evening.
Good evening. The reading, I couldn't help but feel Dean Salzman's words about the perception of truth unites. And the reason I kept thinking about that is, you know, the way that the world is presented right from the beginning of the reading is it's taking in all of this information, all of the, you know, the creation, and even hearing the words, you know, like saluting God, saluting the Lord for the creation of the world. The stars and, you know, everything, including man as humanity. I understand her words even better, because when I'm conscious of, like, what it takes in a way, in terms of the network, what having a good day or having a good time or being conscious means, all the different layers that it means in connecting it, then I understand why she says, you know, the perception of truth unites, because it creates a consciousness about every breath, every thought, every action, every gesture, you know, every movement. And so the image supports it. One of the coolest things about the image for me was the feet at the bottom.
Yes.
You know, and the arms. And I feel like in many ways, you know, we walk around thinking we're so small, but if we really factored in the miraculousness of our being, you know, we would understand what, you know, the ripple of the pebble meant.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Thank
you. Thank you for that imagery too, Melba. Thank you.
Yeah.
Catherine, yes, welcome.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. The words that struck me in the reading were consciously and voluntarily, and it was the ability that humans are given to be able to join in that higher intention by raising our being, by consciously choosing. And, you know, it's a miracle that we're made the way we are. And it just reminds me that, you know, every day is a choice, and our aim for the year is a choice. All of those are furthering the higher intentions of the cosmos. So that's what tonight.
Yes. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for suiting up to play. Is there someone else that cares to share? Ray. Good evening.
Hi. The part of the reading that stood out for me was knowledge of the lower cosmos. And I'm guessing that the author is talking about the mineral, plant, and animal kingdom. And it sort of gave, it affirmed to me this kind of mission for us as human beings, acting as sense organs in a sense for the divine, getting to, you know, experience the physical realm, having a physical body, getting to experience the plant kingdom, having a life body, and getting to experience the animal kingdom, having a desire body, and kind of being conduits for higher beings that don't have that. And so when we're able to stay connected to that little piece of divinity inside of us that Jim was mentioning, it can definitely help us to, I don't know, understand how to relate with those aspects of ourselves.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you, Ray. So, Miss Jackie, I will close this part of our evening with you. Welcome.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. There is something about this new aim, this year's aim of acknowledging finally that we really know nothing and we've never known anything, really. But we have deluded ourselves in believing all of our lives at different levels, I guess, that we knew something or that we were supposed to know something and everybody else knew something. But what I heard tonight in particular in that new context, like Jim, that the divine presence within us, this life force hidden within us and leading us through daily life. And here we are, and we are brought to this place somehow in spite of ourselves and in spite of our limitations, that the Holy Spirit has always wished us and known that we would end up where we are at this time, prepared finally to be able to actually hear this and accept that not only do we know nothing, but we are supposed to know nothing, and that we are here to do God's will and to just say yes. So it's just a delightful thing to be willing to be present and accepting of that reality.
Indeed. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you. It's good to be with you. So the Holy Spirit this evening has brought us our friends, Robin Bloor, and I am absolutely delighted to welcome you, Robin, back with us with the expansion of belonging, man, the microcosm. Good evening and welcome.
Okay, can you hear me?
Get there, Addison.
Okay. Let me share my screen. So this particular talk, I guess the title which Marianne gave me particularly attracted me because of the question, really, to what do I actually belong? And of course, part of the ways of looking at that, you have to look at man as the microcosm in one way or another if you understand man as, in some way or other, within the image of the Absolute. So I decided to run through this as a series of questions. The questions, really, I think there's five of them. There's the fundamental question, which I shall reveal to you in a moment. There's the work question, the question about the work of the fourth way. The question of scale, or the question that needs to go through scale. And the question of time, or the question that needs to go through time. And then the question through Christ. So those are the five questions that I'm going to deal with. But before I do that, I just want to make a point I was taught a long time ago, I would say more than 40 years ago, that it was necessary not only to have questions, but to have long questions, questions that you ask today and you're still asking in a year's time and perhaps even in 10 years' time. And so everybody that I come in contact with a particular way, I urge them quite simply to create their long questions. The questions, the things that they don't know, but the things that they feel they need to know. So for me, the question that brought me to the work, the fundamental question, was a question that was also asked by Paul Gauguin. And this is the painting, and the title of the painting is, "Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going?" And I ran into this question, I think about the age of 17 or 18. And I couldn't let go of it. At some point in time, I eventually came to the conclusion that, to be completely honest, I don't know what I am. So the work question, which I characterize as, what is our place in the universe? And here's a quote from Gurdjieff: "In man, his heredity, his typology, his environment, his education, the shocks of life make him a work of art, a zombie, a robot, a human being, or something else." So what is our place in the universe? So this is a creation in retrospect, and this is a creation story that's told in Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. The absolute, whose prior circumstances we can know nothing about, determined the characteristics of the octave, and he initiated the law of seven and the law of three, and that was the act of creation. He also issues a vibration, the fundamental note or the chord of creation, or spoken of in the gospel as the word. But whenever I think of that term, I don't think of the word as the word in a human language. I think of it as a fundamental chord, almost a musical word. And then he separates himself from himself. His initial note, in conjunction with his two primordial laws, creates the universe. The ray of creation forms. It's naturally trogawato egocratic, which means that everything at every level feeds reciprocally on other things at similar levels. And ultimately, we emerge, we human beings emerge as a reflection of this creation. So the first thing is how, in as small as we are, how would we ever be able to understand the universe or even a solar system or a galaxy? And the concept, as above, so below, is just fundamental to the work. The theory is that God, man, and microbe are all the same system. The mechanisms are the same. The movements are the same. And using this principle, we can deduce the nature of worlds beyond our senses. We can deduce the nature of, let's say, a slug. We can deduce the nature of a bacterium. We could deduce the nature of a virus. We could deduce the nature of a planet because of this, and only because of this mirroring that goes on in the universe. So as the universe is an expression of an array of creation, then man also is such an expression. Man's absolute is his higher intellectual center. We belong because we are the same system as the absolute, as the cosmos, as nature. That's one way in which we belong. We can resonate with these higher beings. So there's a question of, given this extraordinary ray of creation, which deals with extremely large things, galaxies, suns, planets, Earths, moon even is a very large thing compared to human beings. Where do we belong in all of that dominant octave? So the problem is that, and this is in the creation, that there is an interval between the notes me and the notes far in this ray of creation. And because of that, energies coming down from the absolute cannot progress beyond far. And energies coming up from, let's call it the negative absolute, cannot progress beyond me. There is an interval that stops both of those things. So in order to pass that interval, the note do of a lateral octave is sounded by the sun. And this creates the conditions by which the interval is filled. And it looks like this. There's a do at the level of the sun and an octave that descends all the way down to the negative absolute. And between me and fa, the notes la, sol, fa are organic life on earth. And the note la in particular is man. So the other notes blend with the ray of creation. Organic life on earth fills the interval between the planets and the earth, allowing influences from the planets to reach earth. In this, we human beings belong as a channel. Organic life on Earth also plays a role in respect of the growth of the moon. It creates substances that feed the moon, helping to create its atmosphere. In this, we belong as food. In neither case do we have a choice, and in neither case, we belong because the laws say it is that way. But in neither case is there any choice. So the question is, how can we belong of our own volition? Well, the side octave from the sun can also be painted in this way, in which case the center of the earth plus its surrounding metal core plus the minerals that surround it, giving rise to the possibility of plant growth, which gives rise to invertebrates, which gives rise to vertebrates and man, which in turn ascend to angels and archangels. This is called the hieroglyph of life. And it's also referred to as trogo auto ego crap because these things feed on each other. Archangels feed on man, man feeds on invertebrates. These species feed on each other, they reciprocally feed. And it's necessary. Everywhere in the universe, there's a process of reciprocal feeding going on. So this diagram shows a splinter of the trogo auto ego crap, the splinter that involves the earth and the moon, and the splinter that we see in that picture of the ray of creation. We belong to this central column here, the invertebrates, the vertebrates, and man. But if so, we are only a cell in the composite creature called man. So this square doesn't represent one man. It represents the whole of humanity, and it doesn't represent the whole of humanity as it is now. It represents the whole of humanity since humanity was created. This is a depth thing. Now, to understand the trogo auto ego crap, this is just kind of important. It's best to think about yourself, and it's best to think about your biological processes, and to understand that if within your existence at the level of being a living thing, if the right substance in the right quantity doesn't arrive at the right place at the right time, you die. And the situation that the truck or to ego crack creates is that every being at every level is not really a thing, it's a process. And the process, in order for it to continue, needs to obey the rules of its creation. So the thing that defines all of these species, including, by the way, minerals and metals, is all of the life forms, including man, have four things. They have a lifetime and they have three foods that they consume. And these are the laws we live under. These are the laws that make us what we are. So where does that leave us? If we reviewed all that has been said in the previous slides, and we would come to the conclusion that man is just in some way or other a servant within a larger mechanism, and there's nothing for him. And this is the point, and this is the teaching of the word that explains how man can create something for himself, explains from a given perspective. If we belong to the work, we do so because we developed a magnetic center. We were attracted to it. Man lives in the world and he receives A influences and B influences. Now there's A influences. Those are the normal influences of life. And they create nothing in man that is aspirational. But he's also subject to B influences, and B influences are influences that have come down from a higher level. For instance, the Gospels is a B influence. Gurdjieff's writings are a B influence. The Gurdjieff movements are a B influence. They're influences that came down from a higher level and can be transmitted to individuals. And when that happens, then this happens. A magnetic center starts to form. And now the accumulation of influences leading to the growth of magnetic center, but there's two possibilities. One is that you come in contact with not really a representative of the higher, but perhaps an individual or a group of people who have come to some kind of conclusion about the way that life is, prompted mainly by the influences, and they can feed magnetic center. I remember, for instance, being strongly influenced when I was about 18 or 19 by Buddhism. And it was just really being influenced. I read some things that I really liked that had been, that had been Buddhist texts, some things that the Buddha was supposed to have said. So a man may be influenced by B-influenced groups, but there is an esoteric center, and we can refer to this, if you like, the Christian tradition would refer to this as the church triumphant, or the church at the higher level. And if the magnetic center grows to an extent that it becomes really very powerful in the human being, then it may well attract human beings who have emerged from the esoteric center, teachers sent down to teachers. It's a nice idea. It would be a great idea that we could all meet with and be taught by Jesus Christ. But that's not a likelihood in anyone's life. Christ was here for a small period of time and influenced very powerfully 12 disciples. And they spread the gospel, and the gospel was written. But very few people will have been influenced directly by Christ. And it's the same with Gurdjieff. I was very lucky in one of, well, the person that became my teacher was a pupil of Gurdjieff. And there are various things that she could tell me that I would never have known otherwise. So if magnetic center grows strong enough, it may attract sea influence. And that sea influence, it is said, and you can call this as a theory, think of this as a theory, can be direct from, let's just call them spirits at a higher level, rather than individuals. I accept that as an idea. But I don't know that it's true. I feel that I received influences from elsewhere that weren't true persons. And if that happens, then man escapes the law of accident and he belongs to the work. He belongs, I would say, to the church triumphant. He belongs, he's on a path, and that path gives something for himself. The next question, the question of scale is, how big are we? Crooked is the path to eternity. And this is really quite, it's really quite interesting that we are big and yet we are not big. At least that's how I see it. If we look at the ray of creation, I've driven a drawn diagram that looks at it as though from the side. So we have the absolute, which is one, all worlds, which are three, and then galaxies, and there are trillions of galaxies, has been proved in recent times. No one really knows how many they are. And within those galaxies, there are hundreds of billions of suns, half a trillion in the case of the Milky Way is the current estimate, but they don't know for sure. And this gives us, if you like, an idea of the vastness of it all, because we have only got to the sun on the ray of creation, and all of a sudden we're in trillions of trillions of things. But for each sun, there's simply one family of planets. And for each planet where nature exists, where living things have been created, there's possibly only one or two within any solar system. And in terms of moons, they're just a handful of moons per planet. But in terms of the absolute dome, that is the absolute or the negative absolute, what's called the holy firm, this exists in trillions and trillions of places. So the first two levels seem simple. The next two levels are, as a cell to a human body, in other words, the number of galaxies is similar to the number of cells in the human body, or the number of galaxies that we witness right now. And the number of suns is similar to the relationship between an atom and a cell. So if we're going to look at the absolute from the top and find our place, we aren't even at the level of an atom in the body of the absolute. So as I explained, the next four levels are not numerically complex. Remember that the absolute resides also at the center of moons, planets, and suns. Now, there's another thing that's worth remembering. It's that at the moment you are a collection of trillions of cells. There are different estimates of this, but at one point in time, you were just one cell. So it's interesting that we have, from the moment of our origin as this human being, we have grown such a dramatic to such a dramatic scale. So we can look at the kingdom of nature. There's estimated to be between 5 and 10 million species on Earth, including bacteria, flora, fauna, and of course, man. They span multiple ecosystems, dense rainforests, arid deserts, grassland, freshwater, wetlands, and so on. As a species, man belongs to almost all such ecosystems. He can survive in almost all ecosystems, except the marine ecosystems, but of course he feeds. He's learned how to gather food from those ecosystems. The large ecosystems are supported by microscopic ecosystems of cells, bacteria, viruses, and organelles, which govern life from below. In the theory of the work, man is the apotheosis of nature, its finest product, the very reason for its existence. And according to Gurdjieff, nature has tried to people this planet five times. We are the latest attempt. So we belong to nature. And if you actually look and think about the Trog of Alter Ego crowd and the things that humanity feeds on, it's really obvious that we belong to nature in a very big way. Without it, we would be nothing, we would be dead. And nature is the master of evolution. All of those various species exist because nature created them. And is also capable of coping with the whole of the movement of the planet in all its ways. You know, earthquakes and tsunamis and climate change and change at the level of the solar system. Man, in my opinion, should be the gardener of the planet. It is where he belongs. But currently, he's just an ignorant overlord. So this is a poem by a friend of mine called Red Hawk. And it's about knowing our place. And he has Indian roots. And it reads like this. There was a time when we walked great distances carrying what we needed on our backs. Think of it, we stalked game as we moved, ate the fruited and seeded plants, told time by the change of seasons, and knew the land by its feel on hand and foot. We knew our place and the reasons for our nurturing and adoration of the land, our worship of earth, sun, moon, and the creatures of hoof, claw, or feather. We lived by the labor of our hand and the vagrant mercy of the weather. Unless we know our place, there is no grace. Nature will wipe us out without a trace. Where we belong psychologically. So this is the path of the work, if you like. I'm taking the ray of creation and I'm equating it with aspects of the individuality of human beings. So the moon is at the level of hydrogen 96. It's characterized by false personality, many eyes, and it's governed by imagination, vanity, envy, negativity, self-calming, and so on. The Earth, our planet, this takes us to the level of personality. We rise up in terms of the level of energy involved. There's greater freedom. At this point in time within the human being, a deputy steward can be created that will marshal those people, so those eyes within the individual that are interested in the world. So this is where magnetic center steps in. And this is also dominated mostly by mechanical behavior. Then the interval, when we go to the level of all planets. So there's a big movement. If we are going to step from here to here, it has to pass an interval. And this is the level of essence. It's a higher hydrogen still. This is where we develop what the work calls the steward. Someone that in one way or another is capable of commanding all of those things that make up our personality. And here is the level of self-remembering and self-observation. And then there is a level of the sun. And this is the level of reason. This is the level from which all teachers descend, if not from higher. This is the level of real I, and it's based upon a soul that's created by the perfection of essence and then by the perfection of reason. And here lies the second conscious shot. So that's how we belong to the word. So the time question, this is a question that I had to ask myself. It just occurred to me. And it occurred to me oddly because I looked in the mirror one morning and saw that an expression on my face that my father once had. And I wondered, I'd clearly copied that, but I wondered where he got it from. And whether it went back 100 years, whether that expression goes back 1,000 years, I didn't know. So my question that began, you know, at that moment was, what am I now? So Orosz says, time is perpetual perishing. It is the enemy of God. So what can we say about time? The six dimensions of the universe, and I'll go through this quickly, otherwise I could spend an hour talking about it. But almost mathematically, you can think of time, the hero pass, that acts on a cosmos. And there are three dimensions to it, which we refer to as recurrence, reincarnation, and the linear time of the physical body. So we have a position in time according to three dimensions. And we also have a place in time where we are right now in terms of the length, the breadth, the height, our position on the planet, and so on. Time acts on a cosmos. So we could say mathematically that every cosmos has six dimensions. Its place, length, breadth, and height in respect of the Holmgala cosmos. It's now within its lifetime, its recurrence, and its eternity. It also has scale, its scale in relation to the ray of creation. So those seven dimensions determine our place, where we belong within the Trogo or Tuigo Krat of the whole universe. So just to talk through the idea of circular time, recurrence, and essence, it's not difficult to entertain the idea of time moving in the circle. With the moment of conception roughly being coinciding with death. It doesn't necessarily make the experience of time any less linear. However, it introduces the idea of recurrence and reincarnation. We can consider recurrence first, which is that we conceived and die, but when we die, we just return to the same life that we had. And then we have the idea of cyclical recurrence, which is potentially reincarnation, where the cycle moves until eventually we're no longer living the same life. But what am I now? I'm not an object, I'm a process. That smile of mine, is that my mother's smile? From whom did she steal it? How long into the past is its source buried? What's that speech defect that I have? I had it when four. Where did I get it? My sinfulness, my pride, my lust, my greed, my sloth, my vanity, etc. Who did I imitate? Where did it come from? How old is my karma? 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years. How many things have I done which I have yet to pay for? For what am I searching? What are my possibilities now? Where am I going? And finally, the Christian question, what can we become? Your being attracts your life. So we have the four bodies in the ray of creation. So we drew the ray of creation before. And the situation is that the four bodies, the physical body belongs to the earth, the body casual, the essence belongs to all planets. The mental body belongs to the sun. And the divine body, which is possible for man to achieve, belongs to the galaxy. And that's just the theory of the word. So the physical body is obviously mortal. The body question, when crystallized, can survive death. If it's crystallized, it has achieved the unity. And until then, it can die, but it may die soon after the death of the physical body. But if it's achieved unity, it will live at the level of life of the earth. It will live as long as the earth lives. It will persist. The mental or causal body, when crystallized, is immortal within the life of the planets. It's the level of man number six, and has achieved the possibility of immortality at the life of the solar system and the life of the galaxy. And the divine body is immortal within the life of the solar system. It has no further possibilities, but it is able to connect with the abode of the absolute, the Sun Absolute itself. So those are the possibilities of man. And we can see this, we can represent the three octaves that are normally shown this way on an Enneagram in another representation that looks like this. And the physical body is on the outside, and we've drawn an Enneagram within it, which is the Kestian body. And we've drawn within that the causal body. And these are six separate Enneagrams. These are three different bodies that live within each other. Here we present an Enneagram for the bodies. The three bodies are shown according to the body they feed. So the physical body feeds the Kestian body, and the Kestian body feeds the causal body. The food shocks the other octaves. Air shocks the physical body. The impressions shock the body, Kestian. The second conscious shock shocks the causal body. So these are the two points that we are interested in the work, the shock at essence and the shock it's a transformation of negativity, but the second conscious shock that shocks the causal body and makes it possible for it to evolve. So I'm going to finish with the Obligolian strivings, because they are, if you like, the process that we have to become. We first need to understand them. The first striving, to have in their ordinary being existence everything satisfying and really necessary for their planetary body. First, tend to the body. The second striving, to have a constant and unflagging instinctive need for self-perfection. Instinctive, by the way, in the sense of being. So second, we have to generate or maintain the need for self-perfection. Third, the conscious striving to know ever more and more concerning the laws of world creation and world maintenance. The third is to tend to your knowledge of the work. The fourth, the striving from the beginning of their existence to pay for their arising and their individuality as quickly as possible in order afterwards to be free to lighten as much as possible the sorrow of our common father. When I first read that, it shocked me. It never occurred to me that the absolute experienced sorrow. And the fifth, the striving always to assist the most rapid perfecting of other beings, both those similar to oneself and those of other forms up to the degree of the sacred mark fo tai, which means man of light. That's up to the degree of self-individuality. And here is the point, if you like. If we actually progress through these Obligolian strivings, then we get to a point where we are forced to teach what we have learned. And here's the other question. Do I belong to Christ, or do I belong to my imagination of freedom? Because those are two quite different things. And an awful lot of people at some point in time fixate on an imagination of freedom rather than pursuing the purity of the line to Christ. So the first conscious shock, self-remembering, it never does itself. It opposes mechanicality. It is introduced by a struggle of yes and no. This is the struggle with the formatory apparatus. self-remembering is always the second step after a struggle. So self-remembering begins with intention, and it can be provoked by a question. I've been giving you lots of questions tonight. Assume you know nothing about it. What is the relationship between self-remembering and love? It's a question for you. The non-expression of negative emotion is preparation for the second conscious shock. The second conscious shock is the transformation of negativity. Or, as it is said, to make gold, you must have gold. And this is rarely spoken about, and there are several reasons for this. There is no sweetness and light in it, quite the opposite. It's a hard way. The transformation of negativity is hard because you have to seek negativity. And there's no connection with the bodhicitta in this either. It's all about the self. So I gave you a series of questions. And I hope at least that one or two of these questions are useful for you. And if they are, then please turn them into long questions. Now it's Q&A. Jim.
Yeah, thank you so much, Robin. I've always been curious about the concept of recurrence, but the concept of cyclical recurrence really resonates for me as a possible framework for thinking about how life is. And I'm wondering if you can recommend any of the resources to explore that more deeply, any particular books really, or anything like that.
You really have to read Uspensky for this, and Uspensky's New Model of the Universe, and actually, in actual fact, also Uspensky's Tertia Morganum, has most of the information that was ever gathered together. You'll find bits of it in the back of In Search of the Miraculous, but the full treatment, you're going to have to go directly to Uspensky's text, because he goes into great depth about this, and he goes into great depth about the various dimensions in which animals live, for instance. He asserts that two-brained beings live in a two-dimensional world. And it's an interesting assertion. So there's lots to read there. But I can't think of a better place to go for that stuff.
Great. Thank you, Robin.
Melba. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was so fascinating, and I loved it that you put that in the middle of your presentation. You put that quote, "Your being attracts your life." That's how the reoccurrence, it seems like. If your being attracts your life, that's our thoughts, our words, our actions, our behavior, all of that. The sign we were born under attracts our life, our heredity. All those things attract your life because that's who you are. And I found your presentation absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
So I will just say that if anybody in the audience has not taken in the implication of your being attracts your life, right, then they should ponder it. Because what this is saying is that the way that you think about your life normally, or the way that people normally think about the lives, is I do this and that makes that happen, and I do that and that makes that happen. But the reality is that most of what's happening is just mechanical. And in order for you to change any of that, you have to change your being. And in order to change your being, you have to see various mechanical parts of yourself. And your being naturally grows when you do that. And it attracts a different life. It really does attract a different life. You didn't know it, but it does. It puts you under different laws. So people should ponder that, I think. So Tracy.
Hi, Robin. Thank you. And you answered a long question, or helped me, I guess, feel into possibilities of an answer to a long question I've held. And I think I even asked you this question at a prior visit that you had with us, this whole idea under the ray of creation of organic life being a transmitting film over the earth that is a pain factory. And I remember asking you one time, why? why is it set up like this? And I, you know, it's always been so confounding to me. And and even the side octave and that interconnection, I was just blocked from seeing that tonight when you kind of coupled the ray with the food diagram and talked about that, those energy exchanges that have to happen from lower realms to higher realms, and how, as you said, I think it's all the same system, as above, so below. And so the universe is in evolution. And so these energies have to, this scaffolding or structure is getting built or evolving, supporting these higher beings. And so these energies, these exchanges have to happen. And so unfortunately, you know, organic life can transform those minerals and metals, as you said, but that comes through death, suffering, illness, mutual interfeeding, all things that we label as negative or bad or cause suffering. And I don't know, it was very, very helpful for me. I don't know if you have more to say on that that could be helpful.
Sure. The first thing to understand is that we have bad attitudes. One of the first things that I was told when I joined the work, or when I joined the serious work group, was there's nothing you can change about yourself at all, except your attitudes. And if you change your attitudes, everything can change. So there are a number of things that are what you would call received opinions that you never actually investigated. You just picked them up in one way or another as you grew up in life, and you made certain assumptions. You made certain, for instance, you made the assumption that suffering is bad. That's normally the way it goes. And it's like, you know, a large part of the medical profession is based around the idea of trying to prevent any kind of suffering whatsoever. The reality is that there is stupid suffering, and suffering that is not stupid is actually the path to growth. So we talk about negativity as being a bad thing, but negativity is not a bad thing. Negativity is bad when we express it in certain circumstances. It is bad in a particular context. But if we didn't have negativity, we would have no possibility of evolution, none whatsoever. Another thing that most people don't really take on board, or a lot of people I've talked to never took on board, is that negative emotion only exists in people. It doesn't exist anywhere else. When you see something happen in an interaction between two people, and you think that there's negativity in the world, but the negativity that's being felt if two people are interacting with each other in a negative way is actually being felt inside them and not outside them. And it might be being felt in you because you're observing it and having imagination about it. So, you know, so it might just be not just in those two people, but in you yourself. But it's all in you. It's all in human beings. Negativity doesn't exist elsewhere. And negativity is our food for higher development. But first of all, we have to learn to self-remember. because it's really not possible to transform negativity without an ability to be present first. You need the energies of that level to go to the energies of the second conscious shot. I don't know whether that helps, but it
does. You may have given me my next long question. Thank you, Robin.
Okay, so. I'm not hearing.
Here we go. Okay. Yeah, this is my wife's computer. And but Robin, about 16 months ago, you were teaching one of our Thursday classes, and you had a line that really stuck with me. And it was just a wondering on your part, perhaps the purpose of a human life is the digestion, the effective digestion of impressions. And that was on a Thursday. On a Friday, I was driving to MD Anderson for a diagnosis of you know, what seemed to be a leukemia. And all of a sudden, everything changed dramatically. I was put immediately into a hospital and you know, spent a week kind of getting my body stabilized. And I've been basically on an 18-month journey to wellness and stem cell transplant about a year ago. And the thing that has probably given more sanity to the process is that whenever I feel like I'm being hit with something, I say, here I am to digest this impression. It's just an impression. And it just takes the heat, the gas, the friction, you know, out of the whole issue that is being raised, usually by a doctor. And I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for that little insight. And thank God it happened the day before. I think if it had happened a week later, I would have forgotten it. But, you know, it was timing-wise.
I think that's excellent. There's something that maybe will help other people in this audience. I don't know how many people have actually ever thought about this, but we have to, in one way or another, take stock of what we think we are. We absolutely have to do it. You can only do it by self-observation, but a certain number of things that are clues. Right. And one of the things that's just a really useful piece, and I found it really useful, it's the best thing to say, is that the intellectual center and the emotional center and the moving center are just functions. They're just organs. They're like your liver or your lungs. And people, you know, someone has an idea, they read something and they connect it with something else and they have a great idea and maybe they pursue it and maybe they develop something in some way or other with this great idea. And you will find them 100% solidly identified with the idea, but actually they're identified with a mechanism that they've got, which is no different than their liver, really. And it's not that the idea isn't good. It might be the greatest idea that they've ever had. It's that they identified with it because they thought it was them. But it isn't. It's just the intellect. And the intellect is great. It's one of those things. It's the emotions and the intellect should have as much exercise as possible. You know, it's not a wrong thing to have strong muscles, but that's all they are. The thinking center is just a muscle. So it's the emotional center, the lower emotional center, higher emotional center, something else entirely. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So Brad.
Hi, Robin. I wanted to ask you a question about putting some parameters around the term suffering. You use the term useless suffering, which I hear a lot in Buddhism as well. And we're all familiar with the big suffering, like a death in a family or an illness or something like that. But in Buddhism, they talk about useless suffering as you can suffer just from a distraction or a yearning, anything to take your mind off the path, or developing a magnetic center, or anything like that. Would you agree with that definition?
I wouldn't characterize it like that. It's not that I'm saying they have a point. That's not what I'm not saying is I wouldn't use the word in that way. The understanding of suffering is, it's best to go to the etymology to understand where the word suffering came from. And it comes from the prefix, Latin prefix sub, which means under, and espero ferrari, it's the word to bring. So the verb to suffer is to bring something under yourself. So the useless suffering is the suffering that's actually enforced upon you that you didn't choose,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's the case. I mean, one of the things is talk to, we men are useless in this respect, mostly in terms of our experience, but talk to a woman about how easy it is to have babies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you realize that something remarkable is being achieved when a baby is born. But it just doesn't come into the world without suffering. And it would seem to me that that's necessary, perhaps, because of the lives we live, the level of suffering needn't be as great as it is in some births. I don't know. I'm not an expert in that field, but certainly I don't think that happens without suffering. And the other thing that's really, for me, the guide to suffering is the Passion of Christ. There really is almost nothing else that I get, you know, it's like, he didn't have to do that.
Right.
And then you just go through the stations of the cross, everything, and you actually see what he is sacrificing piece by piece by piece by piece before he makes the ultimate sacrifice for mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, for me, that's intelligent suffering. If somebody, you know, you find people are in poisonous relationships that can't get out of it because they can't find it within their mechanisms to find a way out. That's useless suffering.
Right.
It's just, you know, a relationship that does nothing but damage you. It's like being ill and refusing to get better, really, in one way or another. So that's what I think in terms of useless suffering. But I'm not trying to disagree with the usage of words by the Buddhists. I just say the word. As I understand it, uses those words differently.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. So I suppose, does nobody else find any questions? Everybody understood everything. Right.
So I was happy that you brought up reincarnation and recurrence, but I was wondering, is the best way in this system to crystallize things onto your Kesnian body to be virtuous in your thoughts, feelings, and actions? With repetition, with regularity, is that the way?
The Kesian body is built by breaking down the repetitive patterns of your behavior that are of no use to you, that cause problems, basically cause problems in your evolution. That's the activity for crystallizing the Kesian body. And it's just a long subject to go into great depths about this, but the idea of a complete recurrence is that you lived the same life as you lived before. You know, there are people that don't have to repeat lives. And they're people that are not in the bones of history. Some of the worst people it could ever you could ever be are people that are actually necessary to history, because they're necessary to so many lives that they are bound to recur whatever they do. So someone like Adolf Hitler, for instance, affected the lives of hundreds of millions of people. Well, he's never going to escape from his position. He's locked in it. He's part of the bounds of history. Whereas we are trying to free ourselves from that, and the route to free ourselves from that is really, it's in there in your being attracts your life. It's to change your being. And you change your being by discarding useless aspects of your personality that waste energy and replace them with other mechanisms normally, but mechanisms that don't waste energy and don't have the inevitable consequences to them. Is that enough of an answer for you?
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Thank you so much, Robin. Do you have a, oops, we had someone for a moment and they changed their mind. We have time for one more, perhaps, stuperly,
yes,
if you wish, Robin.
Yeah, that's fine.
Hi, Robin. So this is a question that I've had earlier, but your presentation kind of brought it up again. I've been asking or pondering the importance of humans in the ray of creation. It was a very purposeful act, but at the same time, seems that things are very difficult for us. We're up against some very overwhelming forces. Karma and mechanicalness and all the life influences that we're up against. The question of why doesn't make sense, is irrelevant to me. It is what it is. How do I free myself in a lifetime? Also, seems like a formatory question. The only question that I think I come up with listening to you is, what do I do now in this moment? And it's a long question because there is an eternity of moments.
Yes. Let me tell you a story about Madame Saltzman. And a guy I used to know, whose name I think was, his surname I think was Carmichael, I think it's Charles Carmichael or something, but he was one of the elderly individuals who were part of Rina's group. He was long in the work. He'd been in the work for decades. And one day he went to a meeting. Madame de Saltzman used to visit America occasionally and visit the UK occasionally to keep an eye on what was happening in the Gurdjieff Foundations and those places. And when she visited the UK, she would often hold meetings to talk to people who are long in the work that she thought she could be useful to. So on a particular day, such a meeting was organized, and Charles Carmichael went to that meeting, and he was sitting on the floor, and there were, if you like, a lot of people sitting on the floor, as people used to do in those days. And some people on chairs waiting for Madame. And Madame came in and she looked around the room at everybody. And she pointed a finger at Charles Carmichael and she said, "You are not present." And what happened, of course, immediately was that he was showered in energy And he was there, and he was there with extraordinary force. Now think about that. Somebody comes into a room, points at you and says something, and all of a sudden you're having an experience of the third state, perhaps a powerful experience of the third state. What you've got to do is you've got to find a way of provoking those events from within yourself. Because the world isn't going to do that for you. You aren't going to get a meeting with such an individual who will do it for you. She knew what she was doing. So, you know, you've got to make it necessary for you to be present. You know, and this begins with being an active force. And the way that we normally interact with the impressions that we receive is we receive them passively. We do not have the active force running through the intellectual center, which is presiding over the formatory apparatus where all impressions are received. We do not have that active force there. We don't have that active force there. We are mechanical. You have to put the force there. So this involves you creating the initiative. And I'm saying this, of course, it's very easy to say, it's not so easy to do. But you can't, I mean, as Rena Hans used to say to me, my teacher, Rena Hans, she said, you can't live like a sparrow on breadcrumbs. So I don't know if that helps, but it's all I've got for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. I think that's a very good note to close our evening with. I think you just gave us a shock of energy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank everyone.
So let us pray aloud wherever we are, the prayer of God's love, that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and to sleep, rest in Christ's peace. Amen.